All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. And now we turn to Ivan Elin from the Independent Institute and, of course, antiwar.com/Elin. Welcome back to the show, Ivan. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and Happy New Year, and all that. I appreciate you joining us when you ought to be hanging out at home with your family.
No problem. Happy to do it.
All right, so I like the title of your most recent piece at antiwar.com, Extending Nuclear Umbrella is a Bad Idea. And I like the term bad idea usually, and I love discussing bad ideas, so that's one thing I like about it. But what I really like about this title is the term nuclear umbrella. What in the world? Now, I've seen hydrogen bomb tests where it's really not even a mushroom cloud. It's like this giant dome of superheated plasma or something. And I'm thinking that's kind of umbrella shaped, but I'm not sure what it's to prevent from falling. What is a nuclear umbrella, Ivan?
Well, it's more of a metaphorical term. It means extending our deterrent shield to other countries. Now, this doesn't mean some sort of a super missile defense or something, because the missile defense that we have is very rudimentary and not really tested well. What this means, this happened during the Cold War and continues on and has been expanded. This umbrella is actually offensive nuclear weapons. That, in other words, we say, for an example, Taiwan, we imply that if China attacks Taiwan, this could escalate to a nuclear war with the United States. Now, of course, what that really means is, and the politicians and the bureaucrats don't tell you this is, but the Chinese certainly will tell you this and have said, well, will you trade Los Angeles for Shanghai to protect Taipei? And, of course, what this means is that the U.S. is guaranteeing Taiwan's security by holding U.S. cities, including Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Washington, wherever you are, hostage to the to any sort of Chinese nuclear escalation. So, and now there are some people in this START debate that we just had that on the neoconservative side that would like to extend our nuclear umbrella over nations in the Middle East, and we may have already done that with Israel as sort of an implied thing, but they also want to do it to the Arab countries because the main target there is Iran. They're thinking that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, the chess players are thinking a couple moves down the road, and they're seeing it likely that Iran will get a nuclear weapon someday, and therefore we should protect the Arab countries and Israel against any sort of Iran nuclear weapon. Never mind that Israel already has probably 200 and some warheads themselves. So this is a crazy idea, but they're, of course, extending this. We already do this for Europe, as I mentioned, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan. So now they're talking about doing it in the Middle East. And, of course, the Middle East is, if you ever wanted to have an unintended nuclear war, that would be the place where it would originally start, probably, because it's so volatile. And if there's nuclear weapons involved, it could drag the U.S. into a nuclear war that it doesn't really want to be in.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really interesting. You know, we could talk about the situation in Eastern Europe and the expansion of NATO and that kind of thing. But the two most ready examples that you chose, Taiwan and Israel, are both very sort of informal, wink-nudge kind of sort of alliances that got us into World War One kind of things going on there, where we don't have an official policy that says, all right, look, China, we have this so-called strategic ambiguity there. Do we have an official treaty with Taiwan that we're willing to give up Los Angeles to fight for Taiwan?
No, we did it one time, but it was reduced when Carter made better relations with China. So, but the wink and the nod is still there. And, in fact, the last known policy prescription on it was made by George Bush, who tightened that informal guarantee by some of the comments that he made. But it's all informal, and or there could be secret agreements. Who knows? In this day and age, we don't have to have our executive agreements ratified by Congress anymore. Some of them are just made in private. And this is, of course, very damaging to a democracy. And, of course, this could be the ultimate problem with that, having those types of agreements, is we could be guaranteeing somebody's security and ultimately using as collateral our own cities. So I think, and as you mentioned, these are both informal type of things. But of course, we do have a formal alliance with Japan, South Korea, and Western Europe, and now Eastern Europe, and that's not informal. The NATO commitment of Article 5 means that the U.S. will defend any NATO country, and of course, that, as you mentioned, that has expanded, and that means ultimately that the U.S. has always pledged to nuclear deterrent and put the nuclear umbrella. During the Cold War, it was the Soviet Union, but that umbrella is still there, and of course, NATO is right on Russia's border, and Russia still has all those warheads. So the expanded alliance makes it even more troublesome that we're guaranteeing all these countries, these new countries. Our umbrella has gotten bigger and spread out over these countries, and someday somebody's going to call our bluff on it, and we're going to have to do something. And you say, well, you know, the U.S. has a vast superiority over China, but the one thing that China has is they really regard Taiwan as part of their own country, whether that's a legitimate claim or not. They're very adamant about that. And so even if we had more warheads, which we do, they might be more motivated to press the issue than the United States. And the same with Russia. If our NATO alliance is right on the border, even though we have our nuclear weapons stockpiles in better shape than Russia's, we could still have a problem that their motivation in the conflict is higher than ours.
Hmm. Well, you know, I think it's very interesting the way you frame the question about holding our own cities hostage, because I think the way you would see it on the History Channel or whatever is that, well, we promised to nuke Moscow or Beijing if they were to dare do this or that. But you're taking it the step further to what it obviously means, is that, yeah, it also means giving up Denver. You know, that's what our government is pledging, not just to send kids from Colorado to go and fight in other people's wars, but they are holding the citizens of this country hostage in order to guarantee the security of their favored politicians in these foreign states.
Yes, and what's very interesting about this whole thing, and it was during the Cold War, you would go to meetings and people would talk about this, but they would never put it in those terms. So one day I said, I was at a meeting of nuclear experts, and I said, well, but doesn't this mean, it doesn't seem to be rational that we're putting our cities at risk. Certainly a Soviet driving their tanks over Western Europe is not good for U.S. security, but having our cities incinerated in response to them doing that is even worse for U.S. security. So it never made sense even during the Cold War to do it, but nobody ever acknowledged that fact because the implicit idea was that the Soviets would never challenge our commitment to do that because they wouldn't want to get nuked either. And maybe that's a likelihood, but If you're making a promise to hold your own cities hostage to protect these other countries, somebody might call your bluff on it someday. And there, you know, we, as you mentioned, World War One, we had all these shady and implicit treaty guarantees which were called in. Those chips were called in, and we had to other countries besides us and the United States too had to make good on those.
Right. That's the one that became the Great War, the worst one ever up until that time, worse than anything Tamerlane ever pulled off. All right, everybody hang on. It's Ivan Elin. It's Anti-War Radio. He's from the Independent Institute, independent.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. We're on chaosradioaustin.org and lrn.fm, antiwar.com/radio, and on the radio, too, some places. Kelly Vlahos and Michael Hastings will be my guests on the KPFK show tomorrow evening, 90.7 FM, 6 o'clock here in L.A. All right, so we're talking with Ivan Elin about nuclear umbrellas and nuclear war. He's the author of Putting Defense Back into U.S. Defense Policy, The Empire Has No Clothes, and Recarving Rushmore. And that is, the subtitle there is Ranking the Presidents on Peace, Prosperity, and Liberty. Excellent stuff. All right, so here's the thing. We just had this hour-long conversation here on the show with Ray McGovern, Ivan, and we were talking all about the danger that Israel could get us into war with Iran based on the bogus threat of their pretended nuclear weapons program that apparently 70% of the American people believe in because TV said so. And it reminded me that one of these WikiLeaks had it that Berlusconi, the Duce over there in Italy, warned in one of these conversations with, I forget who his counterpart was there that he was talking with, that he feared an Israeli nuclear strike against Iran, and that's something that was left out of the conversation with Ray. But, you know, when we're talking about, say, for example, trying to destroy the Natanz enrichment facility, that thing's under 85 feet of granite. And that's been something that's been talked about here and there, that a war with Iran, an air war basically against Iran, would have to include the use of nuclear weapons, whether by Israel or the United States. What do you think of that?
Well, I think, you know, after the Osirik bombing of Osirik reactor in Iraq by the Israelis in 1981, anybody who's going to have a nuclear program is going to bury it or put it in many layers of concrete and hide it and any number of things to try to fool the Israelis, because, yes, they do tend to go after programs. They went after the Syrian nuclear reactor more recently than even the Iraqi reactor. And
no,
so
that wasn't a nuclear reactor. Come on.
Right.
But anyway, though, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, anyway, well, the Israelis thought it was. So, anyway, the... So they do these types of things, and therefore, you know, countries, any country that's going to have some sort of a program or is thinking about having it would certainly do that sort of thing. So whether you think the Iranians have a nuclear program or not, it would be difficult to destroy it all by just bombing. And the Israelis don't have as many capabilities as we do to do that with bunker-busting bombs and that sort of thing. But even the United States, I don't think we'd be able to find all the sites and knock them out, because they have been buried, hidden, and reinforced with concrete.
Well, so do you think that that would be a danger, that Netanyahu in that situation might go ahead and okay the use of nuclear weapons? Or that the chiefs would, the joint
chiefs?
Well,
if you want to get the deeply buried bunkers, that's really the only... option that Israelis have. They don't have as many conventional bunker-busting bombs as the U.S., so that, I think that would have to be a possibility. But I you never know if they'll go to those lengths. But, if, you know, if Israel thought that Iran was getting very close to a nuclear weapon, they might do that something, mm-hmm. do something like that. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that they would do that.
Well, and, you know, this was something that Phil Giraldi reported back in 2007. Well, originally in 2005, the report was that Cheney had the Air Force drawing up plans that included the use of nukes. And then in 07, he said that he had heard inside from inside the government that the plan would be not to use nukes on the facility so much as, you know, part of the airstrike package right off the bat necessarily, but to hold them in our back pocket in order to tell the Iranians that you better just sit there and take it, because if you start launching missiles at our guys in range in Iraq and Afghanistan, if you start bombing the Fifth Fleet at Bahrain and closing the Straits of Hormuz, then we'll nuke you. And so you better just sit there and enjoy being bombed.
Yeah, well, that, you know, there's all sorts of chess playing that goes on, and when you do have nuclear weapons already, you do have that in your back pocket. You notice that the U.S. doesn't try that with North Korea, because North Korea already has nuclear weapons,
right?
Most likely, and therefore the incentive for these, for any country doing this sort of thing, is to hide it until they get it, and then wave it ostentatiously after they get it, which is exactly what North Korea did. And so if Iran or other countries are working on these things, they do have the incentive. And, of course, the U.S. doesn't want Iran to get these things, primarily not because Iran is a threat to the U.S. Even if Iran gets weapons, they'll only have, like North Korea, they'll only have a few weapons. We have thousands. So Iran is never going to try to launch a nuclear attack on the U.S. In fact, right now and for the distant into the distant future, Iran won't even have the missile that they can get it to the United States. And also, you have to shrink the warhead to put it on a missile rather than just build any sort of big weapon to start with. So the Iranians are a long way off from threatening the U.S., but the U.S. doesn't want the Iranians to have this primarily because it's an intervention shield. And we can't intervene in Iran if they get nuclear weapons. We can't intervene in North Korea already because they have nuclear weapons. So I think it's not really, these programs are not really a direct threat to the U.S. in any sense, but to a threat to the U.S. hegemony in these regions, and also an intervention shield that prevents the U.S. from monkeying around in these countries if they want to, militarily.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, maybe I'm the crazy one, but this all seems to me like the Twilight Zone or something. Ivan, it's a generation since the Soviet Union fell apart. I mean, I remember watching on TV even as a kid, I was a kid then, and thinking, wow, I get it. You know, this is really the history of the world going on here. Wow, I was a kid then. That was 20 years ago. And the Americans and the Russians both, the American and Russian governments both still hold thousands of nuclear weapons, the Chinese as well, the expansion of NATO, on and on. The great powers all still are holding on to their nukes. And nobody seems to be trying to get rid of them at all, which I would think would be the unanimous determination of all of mankind, that we have to get rid of the hydrogen bombs. We can't have thermonuclear weapons lying around. This is madness.
Well, of course, the problem with that is that the countries feel that they'll say that rhetorically, that they'll do that, and Obama's certainly been saying that. And other leaders have too. The rub comes when, of course, you get down to very low totals of warheads. Well, even when Russia and the U.S. get down to certain totals, they like the domination. Russia and the U.S. like to have thousands of weapons because it sets them apart from other countries. If you get down into the hundreds or whatever, then you're talking about, you know, the Israelis, Chinese, other British, French, the other countries that have these things. You're no longer a special nuclear power. And then if you want to go down to zero, then the problem becomes, well, geez, what if one country hides a bomb, and then after everybody else destroys theirs, it goes, I still have one, and you need to do what I want, or I'm going to drop it on you. So, of course, there's countries are suspicious of each other. So there's a lot of roadblocks before you can eventually get to total disarmament. I think that the U.S., at least should move to a minimum deterrent, you know, just deterring other countries from attacking us. And we have this advantage security position, which we never really take advantage of having these two huge moats and weak and friendly neighbors. We have a great intrinsic security in this country. And, you know, if you wanted to just drop to a few warheads or, you know, a few tens of warheads and say, you know, this is our deterrent. Now we can talk about getting rid of them if we can verify that everybody's gotten rid of them. So you could go and step down to that.
Well, and that's our treaty obligation under the NPT anyway, right, is to help
the
Iranians with their civilian nuclear program and get rid of our weapons.
Yeah, well, that's it's a little bit more weasel-worded than that. They said you have to move to get rid of to total disarmament eventually, you know. And I forget what the exact wording is, but of course we can move in perpetuity towards
right, it's a time horizon. Yeah. We never quite get there.
Right, exactly. So you're like going to infinity, sort of. And it's a laudable goal, and I think the U.S. and other countries should work towards that by all means. And you can surmount one hurdle after another until you get there, and there will be hurdles. But another factor is that you can enhance your security by the conventional weapons are so powerful now that many people say you can hit a lot of these targets without having nuclear weapons.
Right. Yeah, indeed. Especially if almost all of them had been obliterated anyway. We could certainly bomb any capital on Earth from the air with our F-15s and our heavy bombers. All right, anyway, we're out of time. Thanks very much for your time, everybody. It's Ivan Elin from the Independent Institute.
Thanks.
Thanks.